meeting of Parliament, Thursday the 20th of October 2022. We continue with answers to questions. Question number 387 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Rounds advise if the Principal Auditor has indicated when he will be able to table his latest completed report in Parliament, and if so, for which year?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Principal Auditor has advised that he is in the midst of finalising the audit of the 2016-17 and 2017-18 public accounts of Gibraltar. He is awaiting changes to be carried out to set the financial statements by the Accountant General as a consequence of his audit, and the Principal Auditor further advises that his report on the audit of these respective public accounts will be completed before the end of December 2022. I will then table them here. Mr. Speaker, obviously those years are still, in the case of 2017-18, still 5 financial years behind the current financial year, clearly. Has the Principal Auditor indicated where he is with subsequent financial year? And in the conversation with the Chief Minister, has the Principal Auditor indicated to him what the issues are as to why these reports are taking so long? Mr. Speaker, I've had no conversation about this with the Principal Auditor, and I therefore have some of the information the Honourable Gentleman has requested. Does the Chief Minister agree that the Principal Auditor's report, it would be more helpful if the Principal Auditor's report were made in the House, and ready and made in the House on a more timely basis? Mr. Speaker, I'm not able to tell the House with sufficient certainty what the lag of presentation of accounts to financial years, or principal audit accounts to financial years, is habitually, or indeed what it would be, for example, in the United Kingdom or elsewhere. And therefore, I don't know that it is possible to do these things within any other shorter period. I think in some instances it's been in a shorter period. I think in some instances, in respect of the time that Honourable Members were in office, the period was longer. So I don't want to venture an opinion in respect of an area which is not my area of particular professional understanding, when I might be saying something which might not be, which might apparently be correct, but might professionally not be correct. At the end of the day, Mr. Speaker, the point of the Principal Auditor's report, of course, is to provide that independent audit and recommendations in many cases in respect of public finances. And we were certainly under the impression on this side of the House that perhaps part of the delay is because some of the supplementary appropriation bills that have to be taken in respect of some of those years have not been taken until recently, for example. Now, that's the case. Clearly, those aspects would be within the gift of the government, and that clearly there would need to be an engagement with the Principal Auditor to understand what exactly the issues are. In any event, seems to us on this side of the House that it would be helpful for the Principal Auditor's report to come earlier, because ultimately, if they are providing that, those independent audit and independent recommendations, it's in the public interest that they should be known earlier. Well, Mr. Speaker, I didn't defer on the question in that position, but I assume the Honourable Gentleman asked me whether or not I agree. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I would once again say that it is not in my area of professional competence to say that it is possible to do these things in a shorter period of time. And I do believe that there have been instances when Honourable Members were in office where the Principal Auditor's report was delayed for longer than it's delayed now. Two wrongs do not make a right. But the fact that I'm pointing to that does not suggest that there was anything wrong in the practice might have occurred under honourable members,
because we are talking about audits which are complicated. The honourable gentleman knows that we took the supplementary appropriation bills that he is referring to and passed them in this House into Act some time ago. So it was everything not just the passing of those bills that was expected, because if the reports had been ready, simply awaiting the passage of those bills, then the reports could be with the House already, but there was still work to be done. And so, Mr. Speaker, of course, as a lay person and at a political level, able to agree with the perfectly unobjectionable statement that the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition has made, but that doesn't mean, Mr. Speaker, that professionally it is possible for the people who are responsible for these audits to do them more quickly. And I don't think anybody should consider that there is a criticism, at least from the point of view of the government, that the Principal Audit Office is taking the time that they consider is necessary and appropriate to do the important work of auditing the accounts of the government of Gibraltar. Next question. Question number 288 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Ray R. M. Clinton. Mr. Speaker, can the government advise where the counties of the income tax office are being closed? Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to Question 767 of 2022, which confirms that counties are now open. The counties of the income tax office have remained closed following the measures taken during the COVID-19 pandemic, and given the government's drive to digitise tax services. As a result, we have also introduced an online service for citizens to file their tax return. This comprises both the income declaration and a claim for allowances. Other services are in the process of digitization, and as part of this transition, traffic has been redirected via email. We nonetheless understand that there is now a higher demand and need for an alternative filing system for the online digital tax return. As a result, we have published the questions I've referred to, confirming that the public will now have an option to file their tax return by email using a specifically designed editable PDF that can be downloaded from our website. Instructions are also available to guide citizens if necessary. Public counties at the Income Tax Office will also open. This however needs to be managed to meet the needs of service users. Therefore, as stated in the press release, the opening of public counties will initially focus exclusively on providing assistance to citizens for the completion of their tax returns. Other services will continue to be done either via e-services or by email. Once the 2022 reporting cycle is complete, I have instructed the Commission of Income Tax to fully open the counties for all matters. This will happen in January 2023. Once we open, the counties will work on an appointment basis whereby the public is able to check time slots and choose when they want to visit based on availability. They will select from a number of predefined services and be provided with guidance as to what documents are required ahead of their meeting. They will also be reminded of their meeting beforehand, allowing them to cancel should their personal circumstances change. These improvements, together with additional resources, demonstrate the government's commitment to providing a more streamlined and efficient service for the public. Mr. Speaker, I read the question, of course, as it has been drafted, which was filed. It had been filed prior to the question was that the Honourable Chief Minister talked about it clearly. And can refer me to the answer, but the answer, it's not as if it was available to us earlier. Certainly working you in respect of that, and looking at that question, as we did, of course, that came later, it has struck us that in the press release itself, the reference to the counties being open was that service was going to be extended for the purposes of submission of tax returns only. But clearly now, the Chief Minister has made clear that those counties are going to be open more widely within a few months. That is welcome news. When could that practice be spread out to other departments? Mr. Speaker, I know that there's a widespread view that counties are not open, but in fact, whenever
I check with my colleagues and I check with the two secretaries. I believe that it's probably one of the last ones that hadn't been opened, and all the others are now open. I mean, if there are instances of counties which are not open, and the Honourable Mr. Singer is making the just stipulations for many across the floor of the House in his usual convivial way, I'll be very happy to hear from Honourable Members which are the ones that they understand are not operating in the usual way, so that we can see whether there is a reason for that.
I think I asked a sort of general question. This is Mr. Clinton's question, but I think I asked a general question after the state of the public counties some months ago. And there were, in the course of those exchanges, we pointed out to some inconsistencies in the information provided. And I said to the Honourable Chief Minister about some departments have been left out, and he undertook to check that with officials. I don't know if he's got that up-to-date information. And if not to hand, because clearly he runs me on a very more and more specific question, perhaps he can write to me on those issues so that we can do our own cross check, because that information is pending, and I'd be happy to engage with him on the issue of public counties, which appears to be an issue of public concern to many people.
But I obviously don't have that to hand, because this question deals only with the issue of taxation. But Mr. Speaker, I'd be happy to write to him, if necessary, with the information. I think that we had a discussion in May, just before the budget session, and to ask the Chief Secretary to give me an updated list of any counties he believes his people are still not operating.
Next question. Question number 389 of 2022. The Honourable Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how much additional annual revenue we expect to receive from the 2% increase in PAYE announced at the 2022 budget?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as a result of the revised income tax standards announced in the 2002 budget debate, including both the 2% uplift to all rates in the allowance-based system and the gross income-based system, as well as the levelling of the applicable tax rate on higher levels of income in excess of £500,000 under the gross income-based system, which goes up to 27%, the government expects to receive in the region of an additional £17.2 million. I should emphasize that is, of course, an estimate and is usually based on average over people in those bands for previous years and may be exceeded or the amount may be lower depending on income and respective people in those bands during the course of this financial year for which they make a declaration. But usually the income tax office makes estimations which turn out to be quite accurate.
Next question.
Question number 390 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise if Gibraltar has been removed from the Spanish tax haven blacklist? And if not, when does it expect it to be removed?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, Spain's blacklisting of Gibraltar was instigated on the basis of their misconception that Gibraltar is a tax haven. The agreed level of cooperation and transparency within the tax treaty is at complete odds with that. I am advised by the Commissioner of Income Tax that Gibraltar continues to comply with all schedules of exchanges of information and cooperation with the Spanish authorities as set out by the tax treaty. Gibraltar's noted compliance with obligations under the tax treaty, as well as public comments made by members of the Spanish government at that time, endorsing the positive steps in negotiating the tax treaty, will no doubt assist in this delisting process. Nevertheless, given that Gibraltar's unfair blacklisting was by parliamentary decree in Spain, there is an internal parliamentary process that needs to run its course there,
concurrently with the ongoing effectiveness of the tax treaty. The government therefore expects that the blacklisting of Gibraltar, which would be welcomed no doubt by all members of the House and beyond it, should be finalised in the first half of next year.
And is that expectation based on discussions with the French government, or is it just a general expectation?
It's an expectation based on discussions with the French government.
Mr. Speaker, is the fact that we have been grey-listed by the FATF going to have any impact on that process?
I don't believe it should, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 291 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Adam Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government further to the question 2022, can the government now provide a detailed breakdown of the FFPM and service charge cost of $9,253,765 incurred in 2018-19 by the Treasury Department as promised on the 22nd of June 2022?
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 392.
Question number 392 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Adam Clinton.
As part of the committee's vote of the 2022 budget debate, can the government provide a detailed breakdown of the office rent and service charge estimated cost of $10.7 million? In the Treasury Department for the year
2022-23.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over a schedule of the information request.
While we digest the information, and there may be things that we need to digest more properly, as we are, as I understand it, this is a list of properties occupied, rented by government departments. As I understand that, that's correct. Can I understand in relation to 391? Can I understand in respect to 391 why there is a cost of nearly $2 million, $1.959 million there, in respect of the ex St. Bernard Hospital in terms of rent?
I assume because that's where St. Bernard School is.
Don't understand, unless the Honourable Member can illuminate me, because the question was a breakdown of office rent and service charge cost. What office rent we are paying in respect of St. Bernard Hospital to the tune of $1.9 million?
The bigger question was in respect of office rent and service charge costs in respect of an amount of money provided for in a particular year by the Treasury Department. The amount of money, Mr. Speaker, is not just in respect of office rent and service charge costs. It's in respect of the schedule that I have given you.
that is how that amount is made up. Not just offices, it's all of those government buildings that make up that amount. And the same is true in respect of 392, where the figure is 10,700,000. So these are the lists that make up those figures which are provided by the Treasury in respect of those amounts.
So I understand, perhaps we need to have explanation again, because I think he's giving the Treasury and he has detail on it. But the question was quite specific about having a detailed breakdown of the rent and service charge cost of 9.2 million, for example, in the recent E91, which is the cost incurred in 2018-19. I'm just looking at that figure. On the list, under the column rent, it says that it's less than the hospital, 1.9 million. And when it comes to, for example, the local, it's 1.1 million. I don't understand why there is a rental cost in respect of buildings that are ostensibly public buildings, or in relation to their prison, where it says 905,000. So I would understand that there is a rental cost in respect of the World Trade Center, which is further higher up in the list, at 146,000, that's clearly not a government building, but in respect of buildings that seem ostensibly government buildings, we do not understand why they are logged as rent.
I'm going to speak from memory right now, so if I am wrong, I shall correct the record when the time comes. But I believe that at the time that honourable members were in office, they introduced the practice of putting some building in a company and paying rent for the use of those buildings from the government. And therefore that practice means that we end up with this situation, where there is incentives for the circulation of money from one hand, one pocket of the government, to another pocket of the government, which leads to the figure that is set out in the account, which is the figure that you asked about. And so to give you the full breakdown to the figure that you asked about, this is the numbers that we're dealing with.
To be clear, from the answer you've just given, he's speaking on the basis of speculation. It's not clear exactly what how all these buildings have been taxed, and perhaps on that basis it would probably be better if we were to digest the information and ask more specific questions in respect of that in respect of the history. Would that be helpful to get to the bottom of it? Because I can see from his previous answer that perhaps it's not clear.
I'm not clear about the chronology, but I'm clear about the practice. In other words, there are buildings which are government buildings which are now in companies, and rent is paid for those buildings by the government. I believe, and that's what I'm hearing from memory, that that was a practice that they began. That is the answer that I'm happy to clarify when the time comes. But what I'm telling them, which is that the government pays rent for the use of buildings which are in companies, which are otherwise ostensibly government buildings, is the position.
And so it would be helpful. We will look at this and then ask more specific questions if need be. Can I ask on the column of service charges and in relation to 391? Why there is a figure of 219,000 there in respect of Lyon's place? It seems a very high figure out of sync with the others.
Mr. Speaker, there is a real answer I can give him, which is that that's the rent.
The service charge.
I don't know, Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure. Specific advice on that.
Next question. Question number 293 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how much the Hidden Building was sold for by Chief Telecom?
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Hidden Building was sold for £6 million.
question. Question number 394 of 2022. The Honourable the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Island Kingdom.
Mr. Speaker, can I run the budget if it has yet received the 90 million premium in relation to the East Side project?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 404. Question number 404 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, can the government update the House whether the contractual arrangements with the developers of the East Side have now been finalised?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the premium has not yet been received as the negotiations are still ongoing, albeit in their final stages.
Mr. Speaker, it's almost a year, I think, probably precisely a year,
where the government made an announcement in relation to the East Side, and as part of that announcement, there was like a funding ceremony. I remember pictures emerging of the government and the Chief Secretary, I think it was, and they representing the developers signing documents. If the discussion was still ongoing, what were they saying?
I don't know what it is that the Honourable Gentleman thinks he saw.
I mean, I don't think pictures emerged.
Pictures were published. There's a big difference with the speaker when you say that pictures emerged, it's as if one is talking about a picture stereotypically taken, it is leaked to the Leader of the Opposition, and he's seen that we are finding documents that we don't want to own up to, and you know, he knows better than most language matters. So no pictures emerged, pictures were published. And the captions to those pictures, or indeed the press release that accompanied those pictures, which were published, so that he was signing heads of terms. So I'm surprised that he feels he needs to ask me what it was that we were signing when the pictures that we published with those press releases specifically said that what we were signing were heads of terms. So it was also made clear. It has many meanings, by the way, and it emerged through the government press office. But one of them is second on that definition. Those places were them. It also became clear, it emerged through the government press office, that they were going to pay a premium of a particular sum. What is it that is holding up the payment of the premium and the conclusion of the contractual agreement? Something emerges, it moves out of the way of something in order to become visible. That's the question of this going on. This is the publication, very proudly by the government, of arrangements that have been entered into by way of heads of terms. And the heads of terms, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, sets out the sense of the agreement that has been done by parties. In this context, I think the heads of terms were a couple of pages. In respect of the largest piece of land in Gibraltar. What needs to be done now is we need to finalize a commercial agreement, which will be many tens of pages, if not hundreds, with a building lease or building license, which, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, is very detailed, in particular in relation to land which is reclaimed, and in respect of which there will be environmental issues, etc., etc. So it appears a little disingenuous that the Honourable Gentleman might ask me whether they might think is going to be negotiated from a few pages in heads of terms to the many hundreds of pages that are going to finally be agreed. Because we can tell me it's sufficient for him to know that we're moving from a helicopter view of the transaction agreed between the parties to the agreement, and he will know that the speaker that one of the things that was set out in the heads of terms was that outline planning had to be provided in order to be able to move to the stage where the premium is payable and the agreement signed. So that is what is happening. And you can understand that if you have been involved in transactions of this sort in the past, as I know that you will have been, who has experience both as a legal professional and as a government minister.
scripture, or you can pretend not to understand it if you somehow wanted to cast a shadow of a surface over the ongoing transaction. I think that you will agree with me, Mr. Speaker, that we should soon be very happy to receive a premium in respect of this transaction, and that we should soon all want to see that this plot under development. Already, the fact that the new territory phase one is almost complete. We're going to see the second phase start already. In fact, the work on the second phase is already done. And we, I'm sure, all believe that it will be a good thing for Gibraltar to see this plot in development, and I look forward to his next question, which I'm sure he will press it by agreement in that respect. Mr. Speaker.
This is the final question.
I'm not asking any more questions. If there's any criticism to be done, it will be direct, it will not be as questions. And indeed, my legal training is sufficient for to use a word as language matters to understand the mechanics. But what we were trying to seek is information from the question to see at what stage they were at, given that with some fanfare it had been said that they would be a premium, a significant one, and indeed the government had put it in their budget. Now, the Chief Minister described them as being close. There's not a sense of how close in terms of timescale he is, so that what is his expectation in terms of the finalisation of the contractual agreement?
And I think sufficient because the Honourable Gentleman has sufficient, and he doesn't need more than sufficient in order to be able to understand, Mr. Speaker.
Sufficient training, absolutely. And I'm sure that we have sufficient training for that purpose, so I think my words were carefully and well chosen.
But, Mr. Speaker, I do not believe that the Honourable Gentleman would be a good negotiator for Gibraltar in any instance, because every time that he asks about a negotiation, he urges me to resolve it quickly. And so, in doing so, he immediately puts Gibraltar at the disadvantage of having to resolve the negotiation quickly in order to satisfy the voracious position that we have opposite. And my view, Mr. Speaker, is that it is important to do the right deal with Gibraltar, however much Mr. Phillips might shake his head. I believe it is for Gibraltar and its government to do the best deal for Gibraltar and for the taxpayer, however long it may take, not to accelerate the negotiation, simply to bring a result quickly. Whether that's in respect of the treaty or whether it's in respect of a commercial arrangement. Mr. Speaker, considering the gentleman, that we might have had the 90 million quicker if we simply did the deal that was first put to us, and then we might have jumped at the 90 million and not have had such good commercial terms. We really might have had the 90 million for the land with the best commercial terms. Just as in relation to the treaty, Mr. Speaker, we believe it is important to get the right deal so that it passes the test of safety and security of those sitting on this side of the House, and not a quick deal. But, Mr. Speaker, the relevant issue is the Honourable Gentleman, in respect of every negotiation, in respect of every... because I will give you the answer, and I'm not going to think I'm going to give you the answer. Your Senator is making an example. It's explaining in his explanation, but he is giving an example.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman doesn't need to get nervous. He has other questions in the order paper in respect of the treaty, so he can ask questions about the treaty without having to rely on pretending to link matters by supplementary. What I am linking, Mr. Speaker, is the Honourable Gentleman's approach to negotiation. And he needs to learn, Mr. Speaker, that in time, in life, time is everything. And pushing too hard, too quickly, to try and get a result quickly, is a beginner's mistake. It's a beginner's mistake. He is wrong to push us to finish this negotiation quickly, simply because we must go quickly, and he is wrong to put us in respect of every negotiation to finish things quickly. So, Mr. Speaker, I am not going to give an indication of how close I might think I am to concluding this agreement, because if I do, I would be negotiating against myself in respect of trying to achieve it. Because immediately the party opposite would then know that I have made a political point about when I was going to finish the negotiation. Of whatever it is that I am negotiating, whether it is a treaty or a commercial agreement,
and they would immediately have that against the government of Gibraltar. And on this side of the house, the interest of Gibraltar and of people is more important than our own personal political interest.
Next question.
Question number 395 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, on behalf of the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Can the government provide details as to the terms of the proposed 25-26 year rollover of the $500 million sovereign guarantee facility to the extent utilized upon maturity on the 3rd of December 2023, as announced in the 2022 budget?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
The figure of discussions with the Majesty's Treasury are currently ongoing. A full announcement will be made when negotiations are concluded.
Next question.
Question number 396 of 2022. The Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, what is the total amount, total annual value of parking tickets, which have been issued to owners or drivers of foreign registered vehicles in each of the last 5 years?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 397 to 400.
Question number 397 of 2022. The Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, what is the total annual value of money recovered from parking tickets which has been issued to the owners or drivers of foreign registered vehicles in each of the last 5 years?
Question number 398 of 2022. The Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, how many speeding tickets have been issued to the owners or drivers of foreign registered vehicles in each of the last 5 years?
Question number 399 of 2022. The Honourable
What is the total annual value of speeding tickets which have been issued to the owners or drivers of foreign registered vehicles in each of the last 5 years?
Question number 400 of 2022. The Honourable
D.A. Seaton. What is the total annual value of money recovered from speeding tickets which have been issued to the owners or drivers of foreign registered vehicles in each of the last 5 years?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Well, it's true that no parking or speeding tickets are issued to owners or drivers of vehicles. Foreign registered vehicles without owning the car are credited to avoid such vehicles leaving the jurisdiction without paying the penalty for illegal parking. If a foreign vehicle is in Gibraltar and caught speeding by a speed camera after leaving the EU, we are unable to obtain the information of ownership of the vehicle in order to enforce any penalty outside Gibraltar. The same is true of Gibraltar registered vehicles outside of Gibraltar. If an individual driving a foreign registered vehicle is stopped for speeding by a police officer, their vehicles are taken on the spot and the relevant penalties can therefore be enforced.
I think I have another couple of questions on the order paper in relation to assistance. So, in relation to assistance requests made by foreign jurisdictions in relation to humanitarian cars that have been caught speeding in foreign jurisdictions. But I'm going to ask a supplementary. I know it's going to impact on that. But the supplementary is this, that I know that, in fact, there are jurisdictions that will ask for the assistance of the voting authorities in terms of asking for the names and addresses of anybody that has been caught speeding in that jurisdiction. And if I can have consistent for the company as well, I received this from Spain, and in fact I think Switzerland as well. I could be wrong on Switzerland, but certainly Spain. So it comes to a bit of a surprise
created an existing foreign authority, but the chief minister's answer appears to indicate that we can't obtain assistance from those authorities in relation to a foreign vehicle that may be speeding in Gibraltar. And it is certain that that is the position, because it comes as a surprise, bearing in mind that I know that there are requests for assistance from the Gibraltar authorities. From the even my understanding is that actually that gateway for information opened for a very short period during our membership of the EU. In fact, after the referendum, where we still had obligations under the EU treaties, and then closed when we left. So I think for a period of about 5 months, we were able to seek and receive information, and people were able to seek and receive information from us. But after we left the European Union, that gateway is no longer available to other countries, and neither is it available to us at this stage.
Question number 402 of 2022. The Honourable DJ Bissima.
Unfortunately, we don't have something here. I don't have 401.
Well, I'm afraid of losing, I'm going to listen to one, and I'm going to answer with it with two. So if the Honourable Gentleman needs it.
Go ahead. If you've got the question 401, we would like to give us a response to the answer to the 402. We need to read
402. I think that's definitely our order paper. So, and it's 401, and you've said the answer provided to the question for the 2022. Please provide an update as to the progress of construction in respect of the Bedford's means and Catherine means development.
I'm so wrong. I'm so wrong. I'm
going to finish that. I will answer the question for having it.
Question number 402 of 2022. The Honourable DJ Bassoon.
The 402 is a chief concern that the government has the required financing in place to ensure that the Bedford East Midlands and Chatham Canterguard development can be completed.
I said the Honourable the Chief Minister.
And Mr. Speaker, explained in answer to written question 67 of 2021, the start of the Bedford East Midlands estate is dependent on the decommissioning and demolition of the ex-Waterford power station and the relocation and demolition of the aquatic reverse osmosis plant and workshop. The contract for the first stage of the demolition of the ex-Waterford power station was awarded in September 2022. The first stage involved the decommissioning and removal of the mechanical and electrical equipment. This has already begun and its program was completed at the end of 2022. The second stage of the demolition work involving structural demolition, for which tenders will be issued this month, a program to proceed as soon as the first stage has been completed. In parallel with this, following the completion of a series of ground investigations and soil tests, the assessment and definition of any ground remediation measures that might be necessary is currently being finalised. It is expected that the clearance of the area required to commence the first phase of the estate will be completed at the end of the first quarter of 2023, after which construction can begin. The clearance of the area required for the second phase of the estate is dependent on applicants' relocation. They are in the process of designing the new facility for which a planning application will be submitted. The forward stage is programmed to take 35 months to construct. In the second campaign, the clearance of the site began in September 2020, following the award of the contract for the demolition of the express site's two buildings. The demolition works are currently underway on a program for completion in January 2023, after which time the site will be fully cleared. There will then be a need to undertake some infrastructure diversion work ahead of the start of the main project to build the estate, the construction of which is proven to take 27 months to complete. No delays are expected to arise as a result of financing. If I deal with the answer to the first question first, in terms of the timelines we've given, they are completely aligned with the previous answers that we've had. So, in relation to
Catherine, it's 27 months, and the relationship with Belisa, it is 35 months. I think the Chief Minister has confirmed that that remains the position. But is it fair to say that in the alliances that we are doing, and I think it requires a further analysis, there has been probably very little movement since our last part of testing back in well, May, it wasn't that long ago. But definitely that not one brick has yet been laid. So in other words, that the construction element, the loan or risk element, has not yet started. So in other words, the 37-month period and the 27-month period, the threats in relation to those two haven't started ticking. Can you confirm that, please?
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the answer I gave a few moments ago, which sets out the position so clearly that I'm surprised that that's the question he's asking.
Mr. Speaker, I'm asking for a decision to send by way of confirmation. Can you confirm that bricks have not yet started to be laid, and therefore the timeline, the 27-month period and the 35-month period, haven't yet started to tick? So now we're reviewing what I'm driving at is that we're looking at quite a lot of delay in terms of getting these projects completed.
Mr. Speaker, the other thing he's trying to do is to get me to do his soundbite for him, and I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to tell him is that we are on target to achieve the timeline that we set out before and for which we are believe we'll be able to complete. When I met the purchasers' groups and respected those groups, I told them that the demolitions would be dealt with in keeping with the information I've given the house, and we are keeping to those timelines. We therefore expect to be able to complete the estate in keeping with the timelines I set out to the purchasers when I met them.
But that may be the timeline when he met them, so he had accepted that his original timelines and were at the wall, that he had not been able to speak to them, and that there was a immense delay and probably not acknowledged, and they also have the humility of acknowledging that there was immense delay as far as these two projects are concerned.
Mr. Speaker, of course I have the humility to acknowledge, as I have said before in this House when I last answered questions and made a statement about this during the course of the budget, that these projects will not be completed when we wanted them to be completed. There are Gibraltarian families that need these properties, and we have not been able to complete them. Because the Honourable Gentleman says, with a smile on his face, thinking that he's caught the fish, there has been a small thing called a pandemic that has stopped us from being able to sign contracts in respect of these works. If we had signed contracts, it would have been bad for the taxpayer. It would not have advanced the possibility of completion sooner. Now, the people that I met in respect of these matters fully understood what was happening. But does the Liberal gentleman think it is in the interest of the taxpayer or of the government to delay these things? Does the Liberal gentleman think that the government would for one moment have wanted to delay the construction of affordable homes for Gibraltarians? Does the Liberal gentleman think that if he would have been in my chair, and despite his legendary indecisiveness, he might have been able to do things more quickly? Of course he would not have been able to. This is not a question of who is in government. This is a question of being able to deliver as quickly as possible for the Gibraltarian families that need these homes. Of course we would have been able to complete them sooner, but it has just not been possible, Mr. Speaker. And if it had been possible, we would not have failed to act sooner to deliver these homes. The people that I know had the assurance that I told them I was giving them a timeline that we would keep to, and keeping to clear.
Question. And make his costume a special thing to my character or whatever. Look, I'm calling water off a duck's back for various reasons. Honestly. And that does not accept that the agree with me that the pandemic cannot be prayed away, cannot be used as an excuse. Because in fact, brick and construction work could have started, and they themselves, in the timeline that they said in the first, when they first announced these projects, these developments were going to be started to be built before the pandemic hit. So we got to check that.
This is the final question from the Honourable Gentleman this evening, and I will allow the leader of the witness to answer.
I'm a personal assessment on the Honourable Gentleman's character. To say that he is indecisive is really descriptive. It's not in any way designed to be an assertion. And I think in his more convivial moment, he would tend to agree with me. So would his best friend. What I want to be clear about, Mr. Speaker, is that the pandemic is not something that is being created in aid. I mean, the first behoves a politician in a mature democracy like Gibraltar to contend that the pandemic didn't happen and had no consequence. I mean, it may be very easy to say that in the context of politics today, and to pretend that this was not something that affected construction or indeed every other aspect of life in Gibraltar. It is their position, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar's public finances are in a state which is not optimal because of extravagant spending by the government and ignoring everything that happened during the pandemic. Because I should not be able to claim or the pandemic in respect of our public finances either. So, Mr. Speaker, look, the pandemic was a reality. It was a reality that gave rise to all construction working stock. It was a reality that gave rise to construction contracts no longer being negotiated. The other thing that we should know that in addition to the pandemic, the other thing that has been relevant has been Brexit, because Brexit has been making the pound euro shift wildly. It has also made it very difficult at different times because of withdrawal agreement, cliffs, etc., to negotiate contracts because, as anybody who's involved in development will tell him, contractors were hedged against the possibility that the frontier might be less free-flowing, etc., etc. So I will tell him that the things which he calls an excuse, Brexit and a pandemic, are actually realities that anybody who is looking at this non-politically and not trying to score points, as he is obviously doing, transparently, will realize actually has an effect of the ability to negotiate contracts responsibly. This is not any contract that you write. If money is your object, you sign any contract with the speaker. A pandemic can happen and you keep paying. The pound euro rate goes crazy and you keep paying because you haven't hedged against it. The pressure becomes more or less worse and you keep paying even though they might have to bring it around in another way. All of the members know that they're doing something, which is taking a persona which is political. For the purpose of scoring, party political points. Because they believe that the people who are going to be purchasing in these homes won't see through them, and I believe actually they're very intelligent people, in particular very mature people who came to see me as a result of the concerns that they had, and the people will not understand the reality of the pandemic not being carried in aid, and Brexit not being carried in aid, but properly relevant in the context of this negotiation. Do I wish we had delivered these homes already? Of course I do, Mr. Speaker. Do I wish we were about to deliver these homes? Of course I do, Mr. Speaker. Do I wish it politically? Of course I wish it politically, Mr. Speaker, because he knows and I know what the value of delivering an affordable home to a member of the general public and a voter in Gibraltar would be. Do I wish it in my heart in particular because of the needs that I understand these Gibraltarian families have? And that's why I work every single day to ensure that we can find these contracts, we can start laying these bricks, and we can hand over these homes as soon as possible. And you can work on that all the rights. For me, this is about more than just politics in this room.
We need a repetition.
Mr. Speaker, the problem with that analysis, of course, is that those were the press release in 2017, which was entitled, Hundreds of Homes Will Be Delivered by 2019. And they talked about these three projects as something to know Bob Belief and Chatham views. The clear indication that they gave to the electorate and people to vote in 2017, and indeed in the run-up to the 2019 election, but in 2017 when they announced it in great fanfare, was that indeed, as the title of what you say, hundreds of homes would be available by 2019 and well into 2020. Now, it may be that COVID, of course, had an impact because there had already been delays. It's interesting to recognize that the delays came well before, because the original promise that they had made had been breached. That's the political point that met upset.
In October 2019, exactly 3 years ago, we went to the people of Gibraltar and explained at that time why those things had not yet been delivered. By a margin of 2-1, they chose that, not them.
Next question. So
But that's my political point for it. No, that's right. And then from the enemy emerges from his mouth of fire. The killer. Next question. Question number 403.
That was thought to ask the supplement, but it's just the one supplement.
I think we had at least three strikes.
I think the first thing that you can find out is that the people are susceptible to the hypotheses now are working.
The amount to which particular word you took offense at.
I'd like to give an explanation. If I'm a comfortable person, you respect the decision. If you're unhappy with the decision, you don't have a kind of feeling out of the mind to prefer or the right thing, and you will respect.
Yeah, I just wanted to elucidate from yourself why, what, which word do you think that I've used, which is offensive in any way. But that's all. I mean, it's, of course, I respect the term.
We discussed
it. Yeah, the answer to 402, if I recall, was that the word is going to be in the delay. The question is more focused and specific on that than that. That is certainly the answer that was provided by the Chief Minister. The question is very specific and it was whether the government had a required financing in place. Does it decide it or not?
I would not have been able to use the language I used in the last sentence of the answer. I gave the honourable gentleman if you didn't.
Is that because the answer is yes? In other words, that one needs to assume that it is that. I think it was that the project will not be the subject of delay. I think you said as a result of financing. Was that the answer? That implicit in that is that the financing is currently in place. Is that the case?
The sentence that he has remembered is the sentence that I delivered, and his comprehension of it is correct, although I don't necessarily agree with the way that he expresses himself. I've expressed myself as I think is appropriate.
But the other member is wrong. I need him to confirm is a very specific question that is being asked. Why can't he simply say, yes, sir? Is the financing in place? Yes or no? Is it in place now? Yes or no?
Mr. Speaker, the other way to ask the question.
I am here to provide the answer. I don't take advice from him on what answer I get.
Let's move on to the next question.
Question number 403 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker. Can the government confirm whether the financial and the contractual and the commercial arrangements with the developers of the Victoria Key site have now been entered into?
Honourable
Chief Minister. Mr. Peter Loper, this is still being negotiated.
Mr. Speaker, I won't ask him how long he needs to negotiate because of his long answer before. But what I would say, and I'll ask, is, of course, the problem with the answer he gave earlier, and indeed the answer he's given, is that he put the center stage in his 2019 manifesto with glorious pictures before of the lovely project that they had negotiated with the Victoria Key developers that were going to be provided for the people of Gibraltar. They put in their manifesto that they were going to publish the agreement whenever they reached it. It's been 3 years. Longer since he announced the project. The problem with the government that we not agree is that they constantly announce projects and then subsequently appeal despite all their non-scripted pictures,
that they spend several years to negotiate the actual agreements that they've told people they had already got in the bag.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to give him the answer about negotiation that I gave him earlier because I hope that he would have understood that I'm not going to set up the clock against myself and the taxpayer in Gibraltar to do a negotiation. Because he is starting to internalize that.
At the beginning, Mr. Speaker, in 2019,
we had an agreement in respect of Victoria Key, which I set out for the general public, and Lord, the one is very critical of. But the one that he now appears to want us to have done was the one that he appeared to be very critical of at the time. We think that, in reflection, we should have put instead in the 2019 manifesto a photograph of the germ that caused COVID, a photograph of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine that we were able to acquire, of Gibraltar's empty streets, and of maybe the Deputy Chief Minister, the Attorney General, and myself involved in the negotiation of the new arrangement for a UK-EU treaty. But, Mr. Speaker, that would have been more honest. Of course, we didn't know about that then. And it is also true, Mr. Speaker, that given that we're going to say that I'm claiming in aid the same things which are, in their view, obviously just excuses when for everybody else in the community they are reality, they could be for him, because I invited him to contemplate and we were a moment away from our government of national unity. And we worked very well together at the time, because in the reality, this was not the time. But, Mr. Speaker, the other agreement that he was asking me about, the 90 million agreement, now means that what some people call the rubble mountain on the east side, well, there was a rubble mountain and they were in a position that became sovereign bay when they were in government, but when we were elected, we found the same rubble mountain with no sovereign bay in it. That is now going to be, part of the deal for the east side government. Which means, Mr. Speaker, that you no longer, and I've explained this in the House, I've been here for that, you no longer need to take, you no longer need to transport the rubble mountain to Coney Island to create Victoria Keys. You can better create Victoria Keys in a different way. There is a different financing cost involved in the creation of Victoria Keys, which doesn't involve, because when we announced it, Mr. Speaker, heaven forbid, the movement of trust that we were going to do, which was going to be terrible for Gibraltar environmentally, where we're going to bring it by sea, then by sea would be terrible also. Mr. Speaker, we've found a different solution. There's no movement of all of that rubber mountain by trucks, etc. I think, Mr. Speaker, with that position, the problem is, we're damned. Whether we do or don't, they want to double it by having done the Victoria Keys Agreement. My goodness, we have explained about how terrible the Victoria Keys Agreement we have said we were going to do would be. Now they're going to double it for not having done the agreement that they've done. They're going to double it for not having brought the rubber mountain over in the way that they said was bound. Mr. Speaker, guilty without a chance of proving out their innocence. That's the sort of charge that we have written put against us every single time. Well, we're going to carry on negotiating the Victoria Keys Agreement to ensure we get the best possible deal for the taxpayer now that the circumstances have changed, now that we're going to move the rubble, now that there are different options for reclaiming in that area. And I think, Mr. Speaker, we will once again be able to do a very good deal for the people of Gibraltar. And when we do that, it's wonderful. I think that's the right thing to do, to give transparency to the people. Mr. Speaker, let's be guilty, actually. You're guilty of many things, but that's not true. In particular, the contradictions that he is drowning in. Because he wants the future that he's done the Victoria Keys deal. And he has, and he looks all the glossy pictures to that effect before the 2019 elections. He wants the future, he's done the Eastside deal. And that he found 90 million as effectively as possible since Blue Water, which failed, it was on his watch. But then he says he wants to say that he hasn't actually done the deal, and don't trust me because I haven't heard that deal. That's wrong, you want to find the deal, or you haven't done the deal. But just be clear for the people of Gibraltar.
the noble gentleman and Mr. Bastina have decided that the rules of the house mean nothing to them. One of them gets up and makes comments, the other one gets up and doesn't even like the supplementary. Let's be very clear about something. The other gentleman is neither dead, drunk, nor the people of the earth.
What is the other member's question?
The question is that what we have to be done in a game contradiction.
Oh, Mr. Speaker.
I see. That is the question. Mr. Speaker, very simple answer. I am not drowning in contradictions, therefore there is nothing to realize. The other gentleman said that I am guilty. Well, Mr. Speaker, I have news for him. He is neither judge nor jury nor executioner. The leader of the opposition, who has come to this place to discharge the functions of that office, such as it may be, with the least popular support in the history of the parliament. He has come first on the list of those who stood for office and were not elected to government.
The respect of the people of the government is deviating.
The reason I have deviated is for this reason. In fact, I think the ranking of the opposition has been very much set out before this, but those who need to change around, Mr. Speaker. Why am I saying those things, Mr. Speaker? For a simple reason. Because the noble gentleman is talking about the election. The reason I mentioned the result of the election, Mr. Speaker, is because he's talking about the manifesto, and the result is going to put on the manifesto. And I don't defend against that. The honourable gentleman would be firmly over his alleged goal if one had entered into council terms with the benefit of the voter for something that would be anti-call majority and would have not announced it. So the government said an arrangement that said the benefit of the voter. We don't announce it because it's not finalized, it's just at the term. And we don't have it. The only people who come in and say, you've got a secret deal with developers in Gibraltar, but you're not telling the people of Gibraltar for it. And you're counting the progress for that. If we do announce it, but we don't get on a final agreement, we say, you announce something and you don't have a final agreement. But if it's going to come forward to say, can't be forgotten. But between 2019 and 2022, those events that we were talking about happened, and they deprived everyone in every economy of being able to progress matters.
I think we're just
explaining the position very clearly. We now need to move on. Do you have another? Let's move on to the next question.
Question number 405 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, is the government aware of concerns about difficulties being encountered by registered Gibraltarians seeking to renew red ID cards?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the processing criteria for identity card renewal has not changed, and therefore, we are unaware what difficulties are being encountered by applicants. As of the 13th of October 2022, a total of 5,372 red identity cards have been issued in 2022. And while processing times may differ, influenced by the number of applicants within a given period, these on average take between 10 to 12 working days to process.
Again, reluctance to perhaps speak about individual cases across the board of the House, but perhaps I can discuss issues with the Chief Minister if there are any particular cases.
I'm sure that everybody knows that my door is always open if it is has a constituent who has a particular difficulty to try and assist in any way that we can. I will say, particularly in a number of instances when I have tried to get involved, there have been a failure of submission of information, etc., and we have been able to resolve that very quickly with the individual. In fact, I should also say in praise of this department, Mr. Speaker, that I don't just hear the bad, I also hear the good. I mean, I'm told that in many instances the waiting period is much shorter than 24 days.
Next question. Question number 406 of 2022. The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, has the government been made aware of why the Spanish authorities have introduced new controls at their border concerning minors wishing to cross the border?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to a recent technical notice issued by the government which can be found on the government website. I'm sure the Honourable Gentleman has had regard to it.
Unless I've missed something, it explains the new arrangements in mechanical terms, but I did not see that there was a sort of clear explanation of why this had come about. And I was wondering if there had been an engagement with the Spanish authorities as to why that was so, if the technical notice starts with the words, the Spanish authorities have advised the Gibraltar authorities that are wrong at a particular date. And the purpose of the question is to understand where this is coming from.
Well, I can tell you that the contact between authorities was at a very local level, literally at the frontier between those who discharge these obligations on our behalf and those who discharge obligations on behalf of the Spanish authorities. And that there is no perception of any change in respect of the operation of the frontier. But this is, in fact, the position for entry and exit from Spain. I can tell him that there are a number of instances where we would also request data or information. Our law already provides for that, Mr. Speaker. The fact that our law provides it doesn't mean that we require it in every instance. Our law is designed to prevent abduction, etc., and I believe that is the situation in Spain as well. And it's more an issue which would be driven by the suspicion of an officer who would be able to ask for that sort of information in the event that he believed that there was a crossing which was not a legitimate, normal crossing. I'm grateful for that answer. So it's not, therefore, I've understood what he's just said. It's not responsive to any particular incident or because they've decided to implement international convention obligations in a particular way as a result of a definitive change of practice, as I understand what he's saying. That's how we understand it, if I'm correct.
Question number 407 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, does the government expect to put any proposed EU implications on a future arrangement for Gibraltar with the European Union to a referendum, and if so, at what point? Mr. Speaker, we're answering question 408.
Question number 408 of 2022. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, will the government put any proposed EU-UK treaty on a future arrangement for Gibraltar with the European Union to a parliamentary debate in Gibraltar before it is entered into?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to my recent Direct Democracy on Radio Gibraltar, where I dealt in detail with the issue of a referendum and any UK-EU treaty over Gibraltar. In that program, I said this. Well, I think I've answered this question on a number of occasions. I think there was a right moment and a wrong moment for a referendum. People elected a parliament for the purposes of the parliamentarians giving effect to their manifestos and to make the decisions that we are empowered to make through our representation of the people of Gibraltar. It is also true that this treaty that emerges the right word to use in a context like that, Mr. Speaker, will change our relationship with the European Union very materially. And the fact that we are in the stage at which we are arises from a decision made in a referendum in 2016. So I do believe that there is a right moment to put the issues that the treaty will give rise to in a referendum. Nobody can be finally standing in the way of the people of Gibraltar expressing their views, especially on the work product that I have led in the context of the referendum. I'm not going to shy away from submitting that work product to a plebiscite, a referendum of the people. But I think it has to be done at the right time, in the right way, and in a way that is designed to empower Gibraltar and the Gibraltarians in the best possible way, in the best possible moment.
because, as you know, and as has been indicated on a number of occasions, this treaty will have a number of phases, and Gibraltar needs to be strong and empowered throughout the period of the negotiation. Finally, Mr. Speaker, at the end of my quote, finally, Mr. Speaker, I do expect to put the future arrangements for parliamentary debate before it's ratified. Mr. Speaker, I do, of course, you will know that I follow the interventions on the media, so yes, I did hear his. I wouldn't say assiduously, you know, well, one has to do it compulsorily, but not perhaps assiduously. When do you know? But Mr. Speaker, I mean, it's helpful for those who are listening and viewing this debate. He has helpfully repeated what he said. But he will understand when I say that he couched that in a manner where it was not obvious whether he was committing to a referendum or a timescale of that. So let me slice it up, let me slice my questions up if I may. But if he's saying to this House that by repeating what he said in Direct Democracy, that he has formed the view that there will be a referendum in Gibraltar on the issue of the EU treaty, but the only question is when. I don't think I count my language in any particular way that is nuanced. I think that I've been very clear, and I want to also ensure that people don't think that the government makes policy and at question time. Calling a referendum is a hugely serious matter. The United Kingdom has got us into the bind in which we find ourselves and in which the United Kingdom finds itself because of what I can best describe as the flippant use of referenda in order to achieve a party political purpose. And I don't think, given the first proof of history since 2016, that anybody would disagree with that. So, Mr. Speaker, I think that we have to all be careful in how we approach this issue. We have to ensure that none of us uses the idea of a referendum in a way that is designed to advance our party political causes. And that is why I feel pleased to say that we must have Gibraltar's best interest at heart in the context of the calling of a referendum in respect of the treaty and the timing of any potential referendum to be called in respect of the treaty. Mr. Speaker, it may be useful party politically for the Honourable Gentleman to try and push him further, but keeping the best interest of Gibraltar at heart first and foremost, I ask him to dissect very carefully what I'm saying. When I have spoken about these issues more privately, I'm happy to have a more private discussion with him if he wishes. Mr. Speaker, I can be accused of many things, but I hope he doesn't think that when I raise these issues, I do so from any other standpoint than believing firmly always that we have the public interest of the voter at heart, both of us, by the way. But Mr. Speaker, and no one asked the question that I'm asking him to make party policy or government policy at question time. Indeed, he hasn't suggested that that is the case. He has put forward what he said on the Direct Democracy Programme as a statement of the government's decision. I'm just trying to understand it by seeking information. And what I had asked him is, has the government, therefore, am I understanding the position properly, that the government has taken a policy decision that there will be a referendum, and the question is timing, or is it the position that the government has not taken a position yet that there will be a referendum, and so it's not necessarily about timing? That's all I was asking. So I'm not sure that I understood the question. If the answer is they are not yet in a position to decide either way whether there will be a referendum, then that's the answer. But if the answer is they've decided there will be a referendum, that the question is when that will happen, that's also the answer. I will speak of my answer is that I believe I've already given the answer, in particular given that I've repeated the answer that I gave in Direct Democracy, which I think is very clear. Okay, I don't find it clear, and
I wonder whether other people in Gibraltar might be in the same position as me, and I would ask the Honourable Member to reflect further on the clarity of it. But can I ask him this in respect of the other question, which is whether he will put the treaty to parliamentary debate? Instead, I asked before it was entered into. He answered before it was ratified. They are different things. So, again, can I ask? My understanding of his answer is that he is saying that he will not be put to the House before it is entered into. So, Mr. Speaker, treaties are entered into when they are ratified in international law. Before then, they may have been agreed, but if they are not ratified, they are not really formally entered into, or they don't come into effect. So what matters is that the House, in my view, should have the right to consider whether the treaty should be ratified, which is what would bring it into effect. And that, Mr. Speaker, is the government commitment. If what the Honourable Gentleman is asking is whether I will bring here a draft for him to mark my homework and send me back to the negotiating table, the answer is that will not happen, Mr. Speaker. The government will come with the treaty that we propose to be ratified. Because if we do not believe that what emerges from the discussion should be ratified, we will not bring it here. We will simply not agree. If the Gibraltar Cabinet does not agree with the terms, then it won't come to the Parliament because the government will not agree. And then we won't be proposing that it should be ratified. But if the Gibraltar Cabinet is prepared to agree with the terms, we will bring it here so that the Parliament sends it for ratification. Mr. Speaker, as I understand what he's saying is, the debate would happen after it's entered into but not ratified. Entered into by entered into, what I mean is signed. I'm signed by the parties but not ratified. That is how I've understood his answer. Am I understanding his answer correctly? Consider the agreement, since it is, will not be signed unless it's agreed to by the Gibraltar Cabinet. That is to say, the Gibraltar Government. And it will not be ratified unless it is agreed by the Gibraltar Parliament. That is usually mostly democracy. Governments agree the terms of treaties, Parliament ratify them. So, Mr. Speaker, that is what's going to happen here. We are going to, as a government, agree the terms if we can agree. We will continue to brief honourable members as we have been doing. And then, once the government has decided that it can agree something, it will come here. Obviously, if the government doesn't agree that it can accept the terms, then there would not be an agreement to bring here or anywhere.
One final question.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. And it is really that does the honourable member not agree that the decision therefore has changed? Because in January 2021, you know, we had this exchange. I asked him in January 2021, is the Gibraltar Parliament going to debate the treaty before it is signed? Are we going to have an opportunity to do so? And he replied, will there be a parliamentary debate in Gibraltar before the treaty is signed? That's certainly the intention of the government of Gibraltar. That's not what he's saying today. The position has changed, doesn't it? Absolutely not, Mr. Speaker. The signature of the ratification. The signature of the ratification. The only thing that the parties do, Mr. Speaker, before ratification, is indicate that that is what they're taking back to their government. And it couldn't be any other way, Mr. Speaker. What's the Honourable Member of the Opposition suggesting? That he is in a different position to leaders of the opposition everywhere else in the world, where governments bring agreements that they have done for ratification by a parliament, Mr. Speaker. And that is the moment when it is signed from the Congress of the United Kingdom and Gibraltar by the sovereign or on behalf of the sovereign, only after ratification, Mr. Speaker. That is the way that it's going to work in this context. The ratification is what is going to matter here. Because any signature that happens before is subject to ratification, but not in the
of gratification.
It's the honor of all the leader with a content. Content.
Question number 217 of 2022. The Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state what equipment and resources were found wanting in the absence of collision of the boat carrier LF-35 with the LNG vessel over the summer?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer this question together with question 3-8.
Question number 318 of 2022. The Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state what lessons have been learnt from the collision so far and where we can improve our preparedness and response in relation to the reoccurrence of incidents of this nature?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism.
Speaker. No resources and equipment were found wanting in respect of the collision of the boat carrier OS-35 and the LNG vessel. The Marine Accident Investigation Compliance Officer is currently conducting an investigation. The findings of this investigation may contain recommendations, but these are expected to be more in terms of how we can avoid or lessen the likelihood of recurrence, rather than measures on how we improve our preparedness or response. Additionally, I must reiterate that the Water Port Authority and its VTS team acted in a proactive and professional manner, which mitigated against a more serious incident occurring.
I don't think anyone has would criticise those hardworking individuals that had to deal with this situation. But of course, situations arise in emergency situations here, and some comments alongside of one of the ministers there. And obviously, there are situations that occur, emergency situations that occur, we can learn from these types of incidents. The reason I asked the question in relation to equipment and resources was in relation to the speed at which that was delivered. I know that some time it was taken to respond. And I wonder whether any lessons have been learned as to what we could do in future in increasing the number of resources to cater for this type of incident in the future. The Minister has said that we have enough equipment and enough resources and there's nothing to learn from that. But I'd be grateful for a bit more of an answer in relation to that.
I think it's a very early days because, as I said, the Marine Accident Investigation Compliance Officer currently conducted an investigation. So we're looking at how things, so far as what we can learn. But we're always learning, because this is a situation that we found ourselves in, and we have handled it in a very proactive manner. We have had the marine industry worldwide come out and said that the Gibraltar handled this situation in the circumstances as well as possible. And we will have to wait for the next few months while we carry out the recovery of the vessel, and we'll see what can be looked at after that.
Just to clarify the extent of the investigation the Minister has referred to, does that extend beyond the causes for the incident?
Your next question on the other paper will be.
Question number 319 of 2022. The Honourable E.J. Phillips. The Speaker, can the government state that it will publish an inch-to-tail report of the independent investigations to causes of the incident and our response to the AS-35 LNG vessel collision.
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Thank you, Doc. Under the Gibraltar Merchant Shipping Accident Report of Investigation Regulations 2012, the Marine Accident Investigation Compliance Officer is required to make available any safety investigation to the public, and especially to the maritime sector, within 12 months of the date of the casualty. If it is not possible to produce a final report within that time, an interim report will be published within 12 months of that date. We're grateful for the confirmation that that process has now been engaged under the particular regulations that the Minister has referred to. And does the Minister have any information whatsoever to provide any update to this task on how that's going and when it's likely to meet that particular target? And any initial conclusions that can be drawn from those potentially interim reports or indeed the report that was forthcoming?
Mr. Speaker, at this moment, we're not prepared to make any comment because the investigation is ongoing.
Can I just ask, who's conducting the report? Is it an independent body? Is it someone who's...
On the point, we've wanted the independent expert in the field.
Can you name that is? And if it is drawn from a particular entity in particular?
Speaker, we took careful advice in respect to this. Because the investigation is ongoing, the identity of the individual should not be disclosed. It should not be subject to any attempt to intimidate the otherwise correct. The president is drawn from a list of individuals who have experience and who are recommended by the United Kingdom Department of Transport, who have responsibility for the Red Ensign. Usually, the investigating state should be the state of the flag state of the vessel, which is Tuvalu. Tuvalu asked that the Gibraltar Maritime Authority should run with the asset investigation, should run with the investigation. We agreed to do that, rather than after investigation in Gibraltar agreed to do that and to appoint somebody from outside Gibraltar to carry out the investigation from the United Kingdom.
Next question.
Question number 320 of 2022. The Honourable DJ Wasim. The answer given to question 254-2022 can say when Gibraltar's entry points, particularly by sea and land, will be recovered from their current deplorable state.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, the government will make an announcement on this when we are ready to do so. Work to add electronic digital systems at the point of being finalized, and we expect to do one refurbishment exercise.
And, Speaker, I received representations in relation to this. I received photographic images of the cruise liner terminal, and it really is. It's kind of all the really bad way. I've also seen myself, and I've also received representations for the effects, following photographic evidence, of the pedestrian access on the Gibraltar side of the frontier. I normally cross over by car, but even the vehicle access isn't that brilliant. But I must say the pedestrian access there as well. I've also received very recently complaints about Gibraltar Airport not being in a particularly good state of toilet there, and so I'm in a really, really bad way. Now, a lot of these things, I think, are capable
I'm assuming that the announcement is a precursor of something a bit more substantive than the part of the project to refer to all these things, that maybe the minister can invite him to elucidate upon that. But does it also agree with you that a quick catch-up job, a quick pay job, would do wonders and at least make Gibraltar better for it more respectable than it currently looks?
Well, Speaker, I have been very clear with all ministers that I think we have a responsibility to be very careful with taxpayers' money at this moment. And I can already read the question that honourable members have put to us is we spent a penny painting a wall which we demolished 4 weeks later. And so the honourable gentleman needs to understand that if we are looking to add electronic entry systems to Gibraltar under one set of circumstances, which should be clear in a few weeks or not, if we're looking to change flows of people in the airport if we do a particular deal or not, key would be the angle with which we would be hit if we had spent money painting that wall 4 weeks earlier. So we don't want to incur a cost to the taxpayer that would be undone a few weeks later. The other gentleman's talked about problems in the courts, which I think either I nor the minister were aware of, which doesn't fall into that category. But all the other instances that he's talking about, which we are aware of, we're holding back on because we expect clarity, which will enable us to make announcements of projects in one direction or another, depending what the result we emerge from the negotiations in respect of the UK-EU treaty. That's why nothing is being done now. We're as concerned that we should look as good as we can, but we're also concerned not to spend money unnecessarily. Those are two conflicting situations, and I'm sure, given what they constantly tell us, that we mustn't be overspent in any head in the budget book, that they wouldn't want us to paint the same wall twice, which is exactly what I'm saying would happen if we were to move now.
I also know that reply addresses, I think, some of the entry points. If I'm coming to the honourable gentleman, I think that is a very weak response. But certainly, a cool line of travel, I'm not sure that is going to be in any way impacted by the negotiations in the EU treaty. But can I just assuage the concerns that the government has in relation to this? I can undertake that I will make absolutely no criticism should they spend at least a bit of money for a creative piece to improve those exit points. I think this would be a reasonable initiative on the part of the government. And in terms of a specific question, Peter, can I ask the minister? I think he said that he would be making an announcement soon, or work to that effect. But did you think that say that the research center of the service works is going to be a bit more imminent than others? I didn't quite like that he was shaking his head. So if you can elucidate in relation to that, what is it that I did say in the course of my preamble to my earlier question, where it was elucidated as to what type of work is going to be carried out in relation to the enterprise? I think he's going to make a summary.
But the speaker, what we said, and I reiterated, is that there would be different types of work done depending on the outcome of the UK-EU negotiations. And that in some instances, we would be adding electronic systems, which would do one thing or another, depending on the outcome of the negotiations. But the speaker, we had a number of debates in this house in relation to funding. The other government is saying to us, just with a little bit of money on paint. As if that's where, in the context of what he's saying, is very little money. Well, Mr. Speaker, the other gentleman obviously has not got experience of government, but it is not very little money to paint an area, in particular an area that you think you may be setting to refurbish in a different way depending on the outcome of a negotiation that is potentially going to be concluded in a matter of weeks or months. So they tell us that it's terrible that we are overspent in respect of the Gibraltar Electricity Authority, even where the overspending deals with the cost of fuel so that we can have the right one. And yet now, that's not a choice. If you want to keep the right one, you have to pay for fuel. Yet now he's asking us to make the choice
to spend on something which we would potentially undo in a few weeks. So, Mr. Speaker, I happen to understand that we're not trying to avoid having our entry points as thick and span as we would like them to be. We want them to be totally thick and span. But we think it is worth waiting a little while and having one job done rather than having to undo a job that might be done.
Next question.
Question number 221 of 2022. The Honourable DJ Buckley. Please provide an explanation for the human resources impacting on flight survivors and the Gibraltar Airport.
Answer. The Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, this is a national air traffic services problem. We are in close proximity to the airport terminal director is only informed of mass human resources issues when there is an operational impact on civilian flights. We are to bring managers, but we have no information on any concern matters, including their manner and sickness level, or the contractual obligations between them, as there has never been a direct link to the Majesty's government here. The government is assisting to remove the ready question for compliance with its obligation to keep the runway open and operating as per the agreement with us. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the government and certainly us in opposition are equally as frustrated on this one. We do appreciate on this side of the house that the legal factual realities of that the government in a direct way has in some respects very little it can do, because of setting up the government's foot. But clearly, we all agree across the floor of this house. Judged by the test statement that we have both made as a result of this issue, that the closure so often in the recent history is having an impact on flight arrivals. I said that's an obvious point. The danger there then becomes that it could have a more medium to long term effect in terms of our reputation and the impact on the efforts that the government may be doing to attract more airlines and more aircraft in the future border. Can I ask him whether he has any further information, any further updates as to a proper resolution to what appear to be human resources issues, impacting particularly in relation to sick leave? I imagine there is sick leave, and therefore there aren't enough people to cover those unfortunate absences. It's something that, as far as I'm concerned, from my own memory, never used to happen before. And the data never recalled Gibraltar Airport has been closed as a result. You can ask him for that information. I think I had a meeting this morning, because it's my responsibility to meet with the commander for the forces once again, and where this issue was broached, and I made the position that it's still narrowly clear on behalf of the government and people of Gibraltar who would accept. And of course, the commander of forces was equally trenchant in his view that the position of MATF has been entirely unacceptable and a failure of their obligations to the Ministry of Defence. There is a chain of agreements here. The government have an arrangement with the Ministry of Defence, the Ministry of Defence have an arrangement with NAT, which is the UK Air Traffic Control Company. Mr. Speaker, the point that I make, and honourable members will remember that in all of the difficult exchanges that I had with Trevor Hammond when he was in this house, I always used to say that he was an excellent professor in his field, which was air traffic control, etc. Mr. Speaker will remember that I often berated him for not being an expert on gas, but I said he was an excellent professional when it came to the safe management of our aircraft. It never used to happen when Trevor Hammond was in charge, not that, Mr. Speaker. And I note that point repeatedly to CBF and to others. And I'm very concerned because of the absence of an understanding of Gibraltar Airport at the management level that NAT may have been lost. And that is one of the concerns that I believe CBF also understands and has and is communicating to NAT. But I do feel that we are not out of the woods yet and that we're going to still have a number of instances where we're going to see Gibraltar Airfield not be able to operate in the hours when it should be operating, whilst they train up new people who are being recruited. And it is not possible to bring people from the United Kingdom to simply do the job here because they need to have specific qualifications, which type or knowledge, which takes time to acquire. So you can't simply fly people out to fill the gap that you have. You have to recruit people and train them, and that is going to take a number of months. And the position of the government of Gibraltar and the people of Gibraltar has made extraordinarily clear to the Ministry of Defence and from the Ministry of Defence also to NAF. And the government has reduced the amount that we pay under the custom and legal agreement as a result of the hours of operation of the airfield being reduced. Now, that may not seem like much of a sledgehammer in the negotiations, but as the Honourable Gentleman thinks, if we have a weapon that we're not using, perhaps instead of asking us to use it, he might point us where it is.
Asking a very specific question, I said that he has in relation to Trevor Tavani, who is not somebody who's my first cousin, but he's kind of specific question is, if it is a reason of the problem, and I don't want to be a problem now, if it is a reason of the problem increasing the complement, if I've understood him correctly from his meeting with the CBS this morning, and is the problem certainly, is that a concern that is the negative impact on eligible to the operation?
Then, the reason for the problem is recruitment. One of the aspects which requires recruitment, and probably the principal aspect, is sick leave. But not just sick leave on its own. I mean, remember that we do have something that they say outgrown-aid, but which has physical realities that manifest themselves mainly COVID, which has affected every aspect of how we run and others run their organisations. And which continues to affect us because we ask people not to come to work in certain circumstances or not to infect others. So the COVID is still there. I mean, it's not a killer anymore in the way that it was. It's still, unfortunately, going to rise to some, but with a vaccine, we're able to live with it. But it doesn't mean that we want people who have it to come to work because there could be issues with infecting others. So all of that is happening in the background. And those are the things that I have been told. Which I'm happy to share with him and to continue the references of Paul in respect to this project.
Next question. Question number 322 of 2022. The Honourable Dijon Buffoon. He states specifically how the government expects the private sector to invest in developing tourism in Gibraltar and what policy measures, if any, would it introduce to encourage that investment to take.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism. Mr. Speaker, the member opposite is asking me the same question that GBC recently asked me in an interview. There are several ways in which we can see private sector investment taking place, improving grappling, joint marketing, and new businesses related to tourism. These are a few examples of private sector investment or involvement. Mr. Rosina should know that we are working with a new CEO, Mr. Rosina, to establish how best to progress this way of working. I am happy to brief Mr. Rosina on the advice we received from Mr. Rosina in this respect.
I was waiting for that, Mr. Speaker, and it has arrived. But so yes, I'm sure Mr. Rosina, the CEO of GDB, will do a very good job, and that's what he's certain of. So, in fact, the question better arises from his interview with BBC, although I know that he made those comments in that interview, I didn't actually watch the interview myself, but it actually arises from comments he made to the Gibraltar Business Magazine in his last edition. And if I could quote just a few of the things that he said, well, this is not him saying it, it's the reporter, the journalist saying, well, I don't know what he was looking to the guy from what he said, and so it's in conflict with what he told the public via BBC. But in the private sector needs to invest more in tourism, which is, I think, in essence, what he told BBC. And he talked about maybe by looking into some sort of partnership with governments, I'm happy to discuss ideas with them. Now, I mean, the reason why I ask this question is, and hopefully he's given an answer in this house, but I'm afraid to say that, yes, there may be some more particulars in what he has said now, it isn't particularly particular. And he talks about improving the offering and marketing and things like that. I asked specifically whether there was a policy measure in relation to this. So, is there anything other than a sort of general comment about how he wishes the private sector and his encouragement of the private sector to invest in the services project? Is there anything more specific that the government is doing by way of, I don't know, financial assistance? And for example, the Honourable, the father of the head person, replied to questions posed by my other friend and colleague of the UDL opposition, didn't provide the specific criteria which would influence him as to whether he would accept new investments or participate in that investment, but he had showed a bit more information as to what the general guidelines were. But I don't see that from the Honourable Member. Speaker, there's no work that goes on behind the scenes. When I talk about the private sector, I'm always talking to members of the private sector, businesses related to tourism, because they're key to this whole to the tourism business going forward. We need to understand that the government has invested a lot of funds over the last 10 years in our tourism product, in beautifying, you know, the nature reserve, the suspension bridge, investment in the market space, the study walk, all these things have been achieved over the last 5 years. So we've invested a lot of funds in this. So what I would like to see now is when you use the word partnership is, can be looked at in different ways. One of the examples I would give you is joint marketing. The government has certain funds that we can invest in marketing. We need to be careful at the times that we're in at the moment. But if we had a partnership on marketing with the private sector, like I said, I'll give you an example. I was at a trade fair recently where you don't have a stand, what I would describe as a modest stand, and then you have a bit of switching your foot, which will remain nameless at the moment. And you know, they make the stand. There were about 20 people on the stand. And I thought, this is quite impressive. And I said, some of them in the trade then had a partnership with the private sector. You have hotels, you had people who had businesses related to tourism, the government, everybody was together. And I think that's what I mean when I say partnership or when I mean involvement. It's important to have some form of involvement from the private sector because we benefit too. Some form of involvement is right, but he seems to have, and there's always been private sector investment in tourism. I mean, building hotels and things like that. But he seems to be calling for something different. Because he seems to be calling for, the words he uses, he says, are investing more in tourism, and he wants that private sector involvement. Now, his response has been focused specifically on the issue of marketing, which is fine. But in his introduction to the reply, he was talking about more sort of brick and mortar type investments. When he talks about the expenditure, which I think has come from the government finances in relation to the skywalk and things like that. Is he looking at something like that as well, whereby the private sector would perhaps in partnership with the government put some money in return, presumably, for some profit-making activity which would be a benefit to them, because it would have to be a benefit to the private sector as well. Is something that he's looking in terms of a bit some more fair as a project that he has in mind? Yeah, I said there's a lot of work that is going on behind the scenes, and I can tell you that there are certain projects that I have. I feel reluctant to announce them because we don't know where we're going. The people said that we need to see what happens with the treaty over the coming months, so we need to wait a little bit to be a bit more patient. But I can tell you, rest assured that we will be making some announcements. We've got some good projects online. One final question, I'm grateful to the speaker for his views. Is he telling the House that the announcement has been stand in relation to the further particularity that I'm seeking?
is being held back as a result of the conclusion of the EU-CC negotiations. Is that my understanding correct?
Of course it is, Mr. Speaker.
Of course it is. How could it not?
The whole issue of entry into Gibraltar and whether the people coming from Schengen areas will pass a passport control and those coming from outside will pass a different passport control goes to the root of how tourists will access Gibraltar. And that is one of the things he knows and the whole of Gibraltar knows has been negotiated in the context of the treaty. So, of course, this is going to be an issue that needs to be determined before people make decisions about which investments to make in Gibraltar. Because it's not that there isn't going to be investments if you do one or you do the other, so there may be different investments geared to different options.
Next question.
Question number 223 of 2022. The Honourable D. J. I can provide the following details relating to the Minister for Tourism's recently launched Gibraltar Maritime Day. One, how many events have been held to date? Two, who comprised the government delegation at each event? Three, the total cost of each trip broken down into air travel costs, lodgings and entertainment? Four, who the Minister met at each event? Five, what new business has been secured as a result of each trip? And six, the duration of each trip?
Answer, The Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, no events have been held to date. Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Minister to a press release which we issued on the 8th of August. I'm sure he's aware of it, and I'm sure he's got aware of part of his supplementary preparation. It's by 26th of 2022, and in that press release, which is where he announced his project in relation to Gibraltar Maritime Day, which is described as a new project that will help showcase Gibraltar maritime products abroad, and talking about bespoke events. There's a specific reference to the first event being held in London on 20 September. Can you explain why did that event not take place? The event did not take place. The reason was, the first reason was that we were dealing with OS 35. The captain of the port was busy, of course. This was going to be a project that was led by the Port Authority and the Maritime Administration. Both were, as I say, engaged with the OS 35 incident. When we were considering going ahead with it, but then, obviously, there was also the third party of Her Majesty, and we decided to postpone the event. And what would the event have looked like? Because he talks about this particular project, which he described as Gibraltar Maritime Day, which I imagine, I mean, it's activities like that, which in his ministry, during this government's time, and indeed, in Peter Sutter government seems to do, not something new. I just want to be a little bit further how he wishes to, how he thinks this project is going to be different to what we've done before. I know in the press release he talks about the bespoke events, but nothing much more than that. So maybe perhaps he can expand on that, particularly in terms of what he was planning to do for that event on the 20th of September. The other member will know that we, the Port Authority, always we've been inserted with new events in Gibraltar, which is now Gibraltar Maritime Week. And in discussions with the captain, we thought that it would be a good idea to go abroad with a, as I called it, a bespoke event, where we wanted to showcase the port, the Maritime Administration. Obviously, under that, we're talking about ship registration, grant registration, the port of the bunker facilities, something related to the port and to the
specific position of our port and to look for more business abroad.
Peter, I think it was either further. How is that different to what has been done before? You just talk about this focus, this should be focused on our Gibraltar setting as well, so to speak, in terms of its port activity. How is that, and its cruise activity in particular, I imagine, how is that different to what has been happening before, such that described this as a new project, literally in those terms, a new project called Gibraltar Maritime Day?
First of all, the speaker has had nothing to do with cruising. The other important, and this was a very important part of this project, was that we did this in discussions with the private sector, with the airport operators, with a banker company, who are all prepared to support this government-led project. So I think that was important. I think that was different. I mean, I've been minister for the port for over 2 years, so for me it was something new. And I think when I said in discussions with the captain, we both thought that this was something good to do for Gibraltar, especially when the port of Gibraltar has done an excellent job over the last 2 years, especially during COVID when other ports were closed. And we were open for business, bunker volumes were up, crew changes were up, revenue was up, even when other businesses weren't doing well.
Next question.
Question number 224 of 2023. The Honourable
D.J. Is the government in a position to state for when the hotel Indigo is expected to open?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism. I'll answer this question together with question 225.
Question number 225 of 2022. The Honourable Minister for Business.
Is the government in a position to provide an update as to the opening of a third hotel by the end of this year?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
Mr. Speaker, the answer to both these questions is no.
Well, it's a very unhelpful answer on this occasion. I'm always like to try and improve the relations with the Honourable Member, but it seems that despite my offerings, it's falling in that is.
Explicit
in the interview that he offered to the Gibraltar Business Magazine, which I quote, because he talks about, two or three more hotels will help us there. You can think about that because it is well known that actually our occupancy levels are quite high, although I have an issue as to specifically why that is important in terms of higher averages, as we know. But not going there, that is the successor of what he created, which was this, which is the hotel in the world is set to make its debut soon. Now, if I got the hotel correct, is this the one which we could be aware of the Eurolife building by Laguna, the entrance to Laguna State? It doesn't look as if it's going to be opening soon, I must say. So that's why I wanted to investigate that further, unless we have a really, really sort of stretchy definition of what soon means. And then he goes on further, so apart from that hotel, he talks about the announcement of one more hotel, potentially, he says, by the end of the year. And that obviously piqued my curiosity, and I wanted to know which hotel that is. But certainly more forthcoming in his interview, and I wonder if he would reconsider and be equally as more, perhaps even more forthcoming in his answer to this house.
Mr. Speaker, I can't say more.
Mr. Speaker, he said more in the Gibraltar magazine, business magazine. He talks about specifically and I just want to one more hotel by the end of the year. I want to at least confirm that. I think I'd to say which hotel it is, for example. And he says that the amount of one hotel that would potentially be announced by the end of the year. And he talks about particularly about the hotel in the world being open to. And I put to him that that cannot be right in relation to the hotel in the world, because I'm afraid by just looking at it, that the construction is coming, I don't seem to be any room whatsoever in terms of construction in relation to hotels. So I have to tell him with a great deal of respect to him that he's being totally and utterly unhelpful. And I would ask him to deeply consider and provide more details, and I'll allow you to be able to see an answer for him, which is what I expect is going to happen in the next couple of nanoseconds.
And I think the Honourable Gentleman is being remarkably unfair. And indeed, in doing so, it is he who is being unhelpful. The Honourable Minister has been asked if he can say more than he said in the Gibraltar magazine. He cannot say more than he said in the Gibraltar magazine. We're left with at the end of the year. The time has not yet come to make that announcement. And the specific information that the Honourable Member has from those who are developing the hotels is that there are works ongoing. So it's the Honourable Gentleman who, based just on his observations that he might have driven past or walked past the area of the individual hotel, is reaching those conclusions and making those assumptions. And in doing so, is, I put it to him, being both unfair and unhelpful. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, I get up to set up the position of the government, which is to stand squarely behind the things that the Honourable the Minister of Tourism said in that magazine, and which have a life until the end of the year, where we expect to be able to say, before then, we expect to be able to say a little more. Next question. Question number 326 of 2022. The Honourable DJ Bushman. Please state whether any progress has been made to regulate the Indian infrastructure. Myself, the Honourable Minister for Business and Tourism. The government is currently looking at regulating Airbnbs. With the recent success and increase in overnight tourism in Gibraltar, the time has come to be able to regulate the industry and be aware of the details. In a recent meeting with the Hotel Association, we decided that we would start work on this and agreed that we would come back, that they would come back to the government with recommendations. I look forward to receiving these feedback. Again, I'm not sure whether it is a recent success or whether by saying that he's wanting to, I don't know, just as sensible as the Honourable Leader of the House, as well as looking to political principle in relation to that, and attribute that supposedly recent success to his own activity in that as leader of that particular department. But can I ask him again for a bit more information? He says he's going out to consultation, and he's going to be waiting for the results of that to take its course. But can I ask him what his thinking is? In other words, what does he think the regulation is going to be achieving and going to be addressing? Again, I do listen and read what he says. I quote again the interview that he gave that particular magazine I referred earlier, and he talks about nothing more than saying that it's something I'm looking into, and that if he thinks that Airbnb, as far as Airbnb is concerned, it requires some form, he says, of regulation. I would ask him to expand on that. I think it's important to know what exactly is going on in the Airbnb sector. I think from that point of view, I think it's important to regulate. And I think especially when we're trying to be careful my words here. We're trying to set Gibraltar as a potential investment spot for hotels. Then people ask us for figures and you know how many what's the situation with Airbnb? So we're not aware of that. And I think we've seen, as I said, over last year's success in overnight tourism in Gibraltar, that there was a lot of Airbnb. There were apartments being rented out. And that's what's important that we know that the hotel industry wants, I think, to be aware of what is going on. So that's why I've asked them to come back with recommendations.
over the meeting today with the Federation of Small Businesses, and they brought up the subject of Airbnb. And I told them to come back with me with what ideas they had and how they thought that we should do it, because this is a bit it's a new thing. So I think it's important that we get as much consultation done as possible before embarking on legislation.
So that being said, is the rationale behind the seeking of further regulation simply to have, and maybe those things that I'm going to suggest, to have more regulation and more control as to how many there are, so that presumably that will help statistically if people are looking to invest in Gibraltar and open new hotels to know what the current snapshots they're offering is in Gibraltar. Is that for the rationale, but is it the sole rationale? Because I don't pretend that I've spoken to the hotel industry in relation to it, but I can imagine that one concern would be level playing field, and the fact that the hotel industry supply with certain things, whilst these individuals are almost basically a people if it was actually within the regulation.
I think, for statistics purposes, it's important to do that. We're not here to control anything, it's knowledge than anything else. And I think it's important that we need to distinguish that a hotel is a hotel and an apartment is an apartment. So if you have people who are going to come to the hotel and stay for one night in an apartment, then the hotel should consider that as for example, was unfair competition. I don't know. But in having looked at some the legislation that exists in different jurisdictions, there are certain rules, and one of them that struck me was that you need to stay for certain nights. So you're staying for 4 nights, and you can't stay for 4 nights in Airbnb. Is that the same for 3 nights? Then you can't, not just stay in a hotel. That's just one example, but like I said, it's still very early days to go into that detail. I want to carry on contacting the people for the decision at the end of the day. They're the experts in the field. And our new CEO, Mr. Rosino, who is also an expert in the hotel industry, will be advising me on this matter.
The new CEO has the hotel industry running through in his blood. But can I congratulate you on the member for what I think was a very full response? And in the field, I expect him to be answering the question hopefully from now on. Can I ask him, because it really was an interesting response and really helpful, can I ask him when he expects to be in a position to roll out the regulation?
Because, as I said, I'm waiting for the response from the Hotel Association. I think that we have that. And really consult with whoever I think we need to consult with, and hopefully I hope to do this as soon as possible, because I think that's what the industry wants.
Very one simple question. Is the government considering short-term holiday lettering legislation around this area? Because that might be one way of looking after those that also afford protections for those that rent accommodation in this way.
Yeah, it's not something that's been brought to my attention. So I'm happy to entertain if you have any sort of more further information on it, I'm happy to look into it.
Next question. Question number 327 of 2023. The Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Good evening.
Mr. Speaker. That the port affairs can operate exclusion zones around LNG vessels. Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Tourism.
There are no specific or extraordinary exclusion zones established around LNG vessels specifically at anchor, particularly when they are not conducting cargo operations.
The Minister will I assume, wants to wait for the report that on the OS 35 and Adam Corrupton. But where I would ask him to reflect, would he agree with me that given the what has been already put in the public domain, not least by the Chief Minister, as to the information that was available at the time as to the collision, and that it might be something to consider for the government in future to reflect on legislation to have exclusion zones around LNG vessels that are anchored within our waters.
We will wait for the outcome of the investigation. And what I can tell you is that we apply all industry guidelines to all of your approaches.
Mr. Speaker, given the time and given the honourable members have another commitment that we want to support them being able to attend and to express their own renewed condolences to the family of Terry Cartwright, then I would propose that the House should now adjourn until tomorrow at 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm now propose a question, which is that this House to now adjourn to Friday the 21st of October at 4:30 p.m. Now, I've put the question, which is that this House to now adjourn to Friday the 21st of October at 4:30 p.m. Those in favor? Those against? Passed. This House to now adjourn to Friday the 21st of October at 4:30 p.m.